I'm Greg Johnson. Ask me anything. I've got a few questions that have already come in from some friends. I should mention that yesterday we announced that one of our donors, who is a big fan of the work we've done on Columbus Day and Indigenous Peoples Day and the historical truths that we've been putting out for more than 12 years that contradict a lot of the woeful anti-white, anti-Western propaganda, is having an impact. And every weekend, every Columbus Day weekend, we are constantly bombarded with increasing vehemence with this propaganda against the white settling of the New World. We shouldn't even be here. We should hang our heads in shame. We shouldn't take all of the things that we built here and go back to Europe. Oh no, we should leave all of this stuff for the indigenous peoples, right? It's the classic scam. People who did no harm are being guilted into giving free stuff to people who suffered no harm, all in the name of ancient grievances and crimes, real and fake. We've stood up against that for a long time. Even before Countercurrents happened, Michael Polignano wrote a piece on Indigenous Peoples Day that we have circulated even before Countercurrents existed. And we keep bringing that one back. So anyway, one of our supporters said, I'm giving you a $5,000 matching grant for Columbus Day weekend. And the matching grant lasts a week. And if you can raise $5,000 in that week, I'll match it, but it's all or nothing. And it has a time limit. And I said, well, okay, we've done that once before and it worked. I'm game. So folks, if you want the money to go a little further this time, you should definitely take advantage of the matching grant. Anything you donate during the course of this live stream will go towards that. And time is of the essence because we have less than a week, and generosity is of the essence because if we don't get to 5,000, we don't get the matching grant. We'll get everything that you donate, but we won't get the matching grant. So anyway, if you want to help out, this is a great time to do it. The money will go that much further. So the first question I have here is from Miko, and Miko says, Greg, can you update us on the debate with Mike Enoch? Well, last week there was a post on Telegram from Mike Painovich, Mike Enoch, and it reads as follows. I'll just read it. And I took this as an offer to a debate, right? A challenge to debate. Basically, the gist of it was, is that the people who are critical of NJP and TRS's views on their podcasts on the Ukraine war, people who are calling them Duganists and so forth, they've not criticized the TRS position, the NJP position on this, as articulated on their various platforms. And if these people won't deal with their arguments, then they're just shills and they should be ignored. And I thought, okay, well, that's a challenge to a debate. And I offered to debate Mike. Frody Midyord, who has helped me with the debate with E. Michael Jones months and months ago, he set that up. I asked Frody, would you reach out to Mike and see if he wants to do this debate? And maybe you could host it with Guide to Culture and at Countercurrents, and you could be the moderator because he does a good job. So anyway, I asked him, and news spread around Telegram. I put out a response to this on my own Telegram channel saying, I'd be happy to do a debate. Never got the courtesy of a response. Frody never got the courtesy of a response. Worm tongue Eric Stryker immediately popped up and started speaking for Enoch in various chats, saying, oh no, he won't do it. We don't debate, et cetera, et cetera. So basically what happened is I was mistaken. I thought this was an invitation to debate. They don't debate. That was an error on my part to think that this was a challenge or an offer to debate. I was wrong. I don't understand the workings of NJP. Well, around that time, Joel Davis, who shared my response in his channel, contacted me and said, well, do you want to debate maybe Mark Collett? Because Mark and I had had a discussion of this issue in a stream that I did on The Enemy of Europe for Patriotic Alternatives Book Club. And I said, okay, well, let's wait until we hear from Enoch. And a couple days went by and it was clear that we weren't going to hear from Enoch. And so I said, okay, let's set it up. I'll do a debate and it'll be a week from today in the normal time slot of Countercurrents Radio. It'll be carried on various channels. And there's going to be a discussion between me and Mark Collett about the Russia-Ukraine war. That's what's going to happen. So Mike Enoch isn't involved, but Mark Collett and I will actually have this. I don't really want to have a debate so much as I want to have something where we have, and this was proposed actually by Joel Davis, who's going to be moderating. That's the preference of Mark Collett. He wants Joel to moderate, so I'm going along with that. And Joel had good ideas. His basic idea was that we should each have a little opening statement where we just summarize our views on this, and then he's going to ask us a series of questions. And he gave us sample questions. And I like that more. It's more like a panel. It's more like a three-way conversation. It's not just the two of us having to go back and forth constantly. I think it's going to be more searching and more civil. And frankly, I don't want this to be a debate because, well, honestly, I don't like the hard feelings and stuff like that that often go along with these debates. And I don't like the mentality of a lot of the audience of debates. I think it's going to be a discussion, basically, an airing of differences. I think that's a good way of putting it. It'll be an airing of differences about the Russia-Ukraine war from the point of view of white advocacy. So I have the same question basically from Sutton and Gaddius. Sutton writes in, is Kanye West now the leader of white nationalism? And Gaddius wrote in a chat, can we keep Kanye? Oh, Dad, can we keep him? Right? And it's a great question. Kanye West has stepped forward and made a great splash this week. And I think it's wonderful. I've always mocked Republicans for thinking that we're going to have a black savior who will talk about white stuff and save them from the necessity of being courageous and taking their own side. I think that's utterly contemptible. And of course, what it does is it invites black grifters and kooks to be the voices of white conservatives because they won't take their own side. For instance, there was a hearing about white supremacism. I don't like that term, but anyway, that's what they like to call it, white supremacism in Congress. Now, I tried to get myself invited as an expert witness because I did write a book called The White Nationalist Manifesto. I won't go through all the details, but put it this way, nobody returned my calls. Nobody returned my calls. However, I was gratified to see that Candace Wilson? I can't even remember her name. This black woman from Turning Point USA was invited to give testimony on white identity politics in front of the Congress. That's the way that Republicans work. They're so cowardly. They're so weak. They realize that they are the de facto white people's party because they're not totally hostile to white people's interests, or at least openly so. And they have all kinds of white people clamoring for the Republicans to take their side. And these gelded eunuchs, these cucks, will not do that because that makes them bad people. It makes them bad people to take the side of the largest group of people in the country, the largest demographic, and the vast majority of their voters, even when the vast majority of their voters are being attacked as white people. That has to end. So anyway, we have this search for a black savior that is built into the Republican paradigm because they want to be eunuchs, they want to be cowards, they don't want to take their own side in a fight. And so the black saviors are coming forward, and Kanye's the latest black savior. Now, notice that I'm not criticizing Kanye for this. I'm criticizing all the white politicians who won't say the things that he says. They're the ones who are blameworthy. I'm not blaming Kanye. In fact, I think his views are good. I think he's a kind of nuts, obviously. I think he's a bit of a kook, but he's saying true things like white lives matter. And he was a fervent Trump supporter. And this is the thing that's most interesting to me. He's been dropping red pills about the Jewish question. He's got this vast audience, and he was talking about how he thought these Jews like Jared Kushner, who was the snake in the grass from the very start, he was the snake in the Eden of the Trump White House from the very start. These people undermined Trump's presidency. It's absolutely true. It's a truth that people like me on the margins are willing to identify. But the closer to the mainstream you get, the fewer people are willing to talk about that truth, unless you're a rich and slightly crazy Black person like Kanye West. And I appreciate it. I think it's great. I'm glad he's doing this. It's breaking the ice. It's opening up a huge conversation. White Lives Matter, that has now gone mainstream. And he's been interviewed by Tucker Carlson. I was somewhat not amused by Tucker's attempt to redirect this whole White Lives Matter thing into this bland, universal, ecumenical, all lives matter thing. But that's just the way that these conservatives think. And Tucker hasn't fallen far enough from the tree yet. He's the best that they've got, but he's still coloring within those lines. He's a white person, after all. He can't just take the side of white people, publicly at least. And so he's got to do that. But he rejoiced in the fact that Kanye was doing it, and he platformed Kanye, and I have to give him a lot of credit for that. And I hope that in the future, he gets more comfortable about open white advocacy, because that's the only way we're going to win. It's the only way that white people are going to conserve anything worth conserving is if we start talking about white identity politics. And if it takes a crazy rapper like Kanye West to broach it, well, history is full of ironies, right? And this could be a wonderful irony. There might be a white ethnostate. No, might. What's this might stuff? There will be a white ethnostate in North America someday, perhaps multiple white ethnostates in North America. Maybe one of them will have a statue of Kanye West just to thank him for his service, because he's doing good work for the white people. So yeah, we can keep him, or at least we'll put a statue up of him someday somewhere. So those are my thoughts. He's not the leader of white nationalism, though, but he's braver than anybody in the mainstream. And there's a tendency when people are brave in the mainstream in front of the cameras that you want to confer the mantle of leadership on them. I'm sure lots of Republicans are kind of secretly loving this, but ultimately white people are going to have to save ourselves. But it's nice to have icebreakers like Trump. It's nice to have icebreakers like Kanye. It's nice to have allies who are not white yet support us. We have to be 100% open to these people. Why? Because the way that we win is to have more and more people on our side and fewer people fighting against us. And that includes having allies like Kanye West, who's a de facto ally of white people now. So Kanye matters to us. That's all I'll say. So Spencer Quinn asked me, which is my favorite Stanley Kubrick movie and why? And this is an interesting question. I'll be very, very brief. I've written reviews of a couple of Stanley Kubrick movies. I've written reviews of A Clockwork Orange, which I absolutely hated. And I despise the movie and I despise the novel that it's based on. And I wrote a review of Eyes Wide Shut, which I think is an interesting movie. I think it's an extraordinarily well-crafted movie. I think it reveals important truths. That said, I'm not crazy about watching it, primarily because I am intensely annoyed by the characters played by Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. I just want to throttle these people. I hate them. And I just wonder what he was thinking casting these people and coaxing this particular performance out of them. Maybe we're supposed to hate them. I don't know. So what are my favorite movies by Kubrick? Kubrick is a person that I can grant is a great director in a technical sense. He's a great talent, but I honestly don't enjoy his work all that much. There are three pieces of Kubrick's work that I simply outright enjoyed. One was Lolita. One was Dr. Strangelove. And the other was The Shining. I think all of those are extraordinarily well done, well crafted movies. The Shining is especially brilliant, I have to admit. I've watched a few others. 2001 A Space Odyssey, I can say, is deep and technically incredibly accomplished, but I think it's flat as drama, and I can't really watch it except in small segments, in little doses, right? It puts me to sleep, to be perfectly honest. Barry Lyndon, I think, is gorgeous to look at, very stylish, but it's kind of long and slow and undramatic. It bores me. Full Metal Jacket, again, technically, you can praise it in a lot of different ways. It's a very harrowing experience, but what's the payoff to it? I don't know. It was great Marine Corps recruitment. The first sequence with that typhonic drill sergeant. It was supposed to be an anti-war film, and it turned out to be great recruitment for the Marines. So I just don't know about him. Is it possible to say that he's a great director and I just don't really enjoy his films all that much? Because the films that I enjoyed the most by him are in some ways the least ambitious of his films. And Lolita, in some ways, is the only one that I would say is perfect that I've seen. There's not a thing about it I would change. There are certain things about Dr. Strangelove that are kind of cringe-inducing. It's very, very funny and accomplished in a lot of ways, but it's sort of in bad taste too, I think. The Shining, I think, is absolutely brilliant, but it's kind of horrifying, and it's not the kind of movie I enjoy watching. So anyway, those are my thoughts on Kubrick. Ravenna has written in. This is a new commentator, or at least a new name, Ravenna. Who blew up the Nord Stream and the Kerch Bridge? That's pretty direct and simple. Well, I don't know who blew up Nord Stream. I think it's a rush to judgment to pin it on the United States. A lot of people want to do that. I think it's a rush to judgment. Why? Well, because it wasn't delivering any gas anyway. And the people who say, well, when Biden and Newland were saying we're going to stop this, they were admitting to blowing up the thing in advance. They were threatening to blow it up. That's nonsense. That's not what's going on there. They're talking about stopping it, namely stopping the use of it, getting the Germans to not take the gas. They're talking about sanctions, et cetera. That's what they're talking about. They're not talking about blowing it up. And to say that this is a smoking gun, I just think is deceptive, okay? Clearly, the motive of blowing it up is not to prevent gas deliveries for the near future, right? Because that wasn't in the cards anyway, anymore. The intention of blowing it up was to prevent Germany and Russia from going back to business as usual before the war. Now, who has a motive to do that? Well, it's hard to say. It's hard to say. Rationally, the United States should want Germany and Russia, I think, to believe they've got the option of going back to business. Why? Well, because it's an inducement to stop the war, right? If stopping the war allows Russia and its oligarchs to fatten themselves by selling gas again to Germany, which dearly wants to buy it, that's an encouragement for the forces in the Kremlin to finally stop the war. That's why we threaten sanctions. We threaten sanctions to turn them off, to make them want us to turn them back on again, right? We turn off economic activity through sanctions to make them want, to make them scream, turn it back on, turn it back on. Give us the gas, or give us the market again. That's why we do it. It doesn't make any sense to make that impossible. And I don't think Nord Stream is going to be delivering any gas in the future at all. I think it's pretty much totaled, except I think for one pipe. Okay, this represents the destruction of billions of dollars of capital. And if Russia and Germany are going to go back to business as usual, it's not going to be anytime soon, and it's going to be at enormous expense. From the point of view of imposing sanctions, it doesn't make sense to make sanctions permanent. Sanctions are there to be lifted once people make a deal. So the idea that there's a motive here for making that impossible, well, you can imagine motives, okay? You can imagine motives, but the stated motives of the United States wouldn't motivate that. So we're off into basically speculating about people who are not rational. They might be stupid, they might be crazy, they might be evil, but if we're willing to entertain that the culprits here are stupid, crazy, and evil, that expands the number of suspects enormously. So frankly, I just don't know what to say about this. And I think that instead of just trying to push some kind of narrative that you've already got in place by blaming the US or saying, oh no, the Russians did it, we've got to have an open mind. And frankly, nothing should depend on this because honestly, we don't know what happened there. Now, who blew up the Kerch Bridge? Well, obviously, it was the Anglo-Saxons. It was the same people who blew up Nord Stream. I'm joking. I don't know. I've been watching the video, and there is one little bit of video that I've seen circulating on Telegram. I don't even know if it's real or not, but it shows a bit of a boat appearing underneath the bridge before the explosion happened. So it might not have been a truck that blew up. It might have been a boat under the bridge that blew up. It's very, very interesting that not only was there the explosion of the bridge, but also this train was there to catch fire too. And we now know that fires can melt steel because we've seen that burning fuel can melt steel and wreck concrete. Who would have thought that? So anyway, it's an interesting question how this was done. The Russians are claiming that it was a suicide bomber, basically. Okay, well, maybe they're right. Maybe it was a suicide bomber. Doesn't a suicide bombing immediately make you think of some particular faith in the Caucasus and the Middle East and North Africa? Not Russian Orthodoxy or Ukrainian Orthodoxy, not Ruthenian Catholics. It makes you think of Muslims. If it's a truck bomb and a suicide bomb, my immediate thought goes to Muslims. That's maybe just prejudice at work, right? Maybe I should be ashamed of myself. But if it's a truck bomb, which Muslim group did this is the next logical question. Not, oh, it's obviously the work of the Ukrainians. So this is very, very interesting. Maybe Ukrainians are working with Muslims. Well, we do know that they're definitely encouraging unrest in Chechnya and Dagestan. They're definitely encouraging unrest among Crimean Tatars who are Muslims. I don't know if Crimean Tatars are the kind of Muslims who go in for suicide bombings. I've not heard of any history of that yet, but there's a first time for anything. So my thoughts are the Muslim connection needs to be explored here if it's a truck bomb. If it was a boat that blew up, that's interesting too. If it was a truck that blew up and blew up a fuel train, that's just a fascinating coincidence, right? Because how could the truck, you know, you would have to be very, very, you'd have to know the train is there and what it's carrying, and you'd have to have the driver try and get close to the truck and then detonate the thing, get close to the train and detonate it, you know, to have any hope of burning the train too. You know, if it was a boat, the boat could be angled in right underneath the bridge and wait for the train to go over and then detonate. So there's just a lot of thoughts that I have about this. I don't know who did it yet. If the Ukrainians did it, I have no problem with that. It's occupied territory. It was a military asset. It's a totally legitimate target anyway. So I'm not covering for them because I don't think it's terrorism. I don't think it's an illegitimate target or anything like that. But I just don't think that we know. And I think, like with Nord Stream, there's a rush to judgment here, a rush to blame. Why? Well, because people have narratives that they're pushing, narratives already in place, and killer shill instincts, and they can't restrain themselves. And so the people that you would think would be most likely to blame the United States for the Nord Stream, lo and behold, they're blaming the United States. What a coincidence, right? The people who want to blame the Ukrainians for it, they're blaming the Ukrainians. What a coincidence. It might be more complicated than that, and we might just have to dial back the killer shilling instincts, the rush to judgment, the desire to just leverage this latest horror for political propaganda, and ask ourselves some critical questions about it. So those are my thoughts. Nick Gilvey, before the podcast, asked me, what would the ethnostate do about fat people? That's a really interesting question. What would the ethnostate do about fat people? I think that it would be great. It would be great if we had a society with fewer fat people. Why? Well, because fat people are unhealthy. They don't like themselves. And if they don't like themselves, then I have no trouble admitting that I don't like them. I certainly don't like them as an aesthetic spectacle. I find fat people really gross. And it also bothers me morally because I think that they're fat because they've got vices. They're fat because they've got vices, they lack discipline, and therefore I have a tendency not to trust fat people. And maybe that's just a terrible prejudice on my part, but honestly, I'm just going to own it and go ahead with my life. I've gotten really far in my life, and I don't think I'm going to miss any great opportunity because I have a strong prejudice against fat people, okay? And all the fat people out there, the amount of loathing you feel for yourselves dwarfs any kind of loathing that I feel from a distance, right? So don't change yourself for me. Don't even think about me. Change yourself for yourself, for God's sake. It's unaesthetic. It's unhealthy. You shouldn't be fat. You've got no excuse. And what would a healthy society do about fat people? We have a profoundly sick society, which is why we now have grotesquely fat people on billboards and in magazines, because they're trying to tell us that this isn't ugly and this isn't gross. I'm sorry, you can tell us that all you want. It's still ugly and gross, and it's unhealthy too. So what would a white nationalist society do? Well, I wrote a piece years ago called How About Fascist Medicine? And I basically make the case for socialized medicine. We have sort of a badly working, dishonest socialized medicine system in America, but it would be nice if we had honest socialized medicine. And the great stumbling block for that is that healthy people realize that it's just going to be a way to redistribute wealth from them to unhealthy people. So if you're going to have socialized medicine, you can't just have business as usual, right? You can't just say, okay, fine, tank up on corn syrup, get fat, don't exercise, and society is going to pay for your diabetes, and society is going to pay for your triple bypass or whatever. That's crazy. Everybody wants society to pay for your problems, but maybe if we have socialized medicine, we should actually have, as I put it, fascist medicine. Instead of being tyrannized by the sick, maybe we should have tyranny by the healthy, and that healthy people should say, okay, we're not going to pay for your vices. We're going to put taxes, not just on cigarettes and alcohol, and pour that into the medical system. We're going to put taxes on corn syrup. We're going to put taxes on carb-rich snacks. We're going to put taxes on fast food. We're going to put taxes on big gulps. and all this other stuff that is leading to rampant obesity in America. We're going to make the fat people pay for their healthcare problems. And by jacking up the cost of corn syrup so it's more expensive than caviar, perhaps we'll discourage people from doing this. So we're going to make it expensive to get fat. We're going to make the fat pay for their own healthcare problems by taxing them through the nose and through their big lard asses to pay for all the problems that they suffer. But there are other things you can do too, though. You can encourage health from early on. One of the main reasons I think a lot of people get fat or out of shape or just never get into shape is, at least when I was growing up, there was a real emphasis on team sports and stuff, even in PE classes. And there are a lot of people who just don't go in for team sports. And I think that you need to have options for people who are not the team player types to be healthy. There are lots of activities that you can do that are healthy activities that are not team activities. And to make those things available and to get people started on that when they're young, if they're so inclined, I think is a good thing. Another thing is just to make sure that there's plenty of free opportunities just in the design of parks and playgrounds and things like that for people to exercise for free. They don't even need to join a gym. Mixed use development with lots of walkable communities. That is a great thing that fights against obesity and just being out of shape in general. That kind of zoning, I think, should be encouraged. And we should have fat shaming. Fat shaming should be something that happens all the time. And you know, if you create incentives for people to be healthy and you put some speed bumps in the road against people from getting unhealthy, there are still going to be a few that get through. And then I think you need to go to explicit measures. You just need to institute a culture of fat shaming. And also, you need some reparative things. Like, for instance, fat kids. There are always going to be a few fat kids. And you should have fat farms, as people describe them. Not places where they get fat, places where they get thin. Places where they can go off in the summer camp, right? And they can get special exercise and diet stuff to help them break out of being fat people for the rest of their lives. That already exists. That could be done. That could be a program. Also, let's get rid of dumb dietary ideas. Let's get rid of corn syrup. Let's get rid of the seed oils. Let's get rid of the four food groups and the idea that we have to have meat and starch in every meal. That wasn't come up with by nutritionists. That was put together by agribusiness lobbyists who wanted to make sure that their sector of the economy had something on your plate in every meal. It's not the healthiest way to eat, though. So there are a lot of things that a sensible society, a white nationalist society, could do to make fewer people fat. It's not the biggest problem in the world, but once we've solved the problem of gaining control over our own destiny, yeah, we should have a few programs in place to make sure there are fewer fat people, fewer unhealthy people, fewer unhappy people in our societies. So I'm going to check and see if there's some new questions here. What do I think of fat people who claim to be proud? I think they're abusing the word proud. They're not proud, they're shameless, and there's a difference. Gay pride is not about being proud of being gay. It's about being shameless about being gay. You know, gay pride, fat pride, it's really gay shamelessness and fat shamelessness. And you should be definitely ashamed of being fat. Okay? So that's my thought about being proud of being fat. Nobody's actually proud of being fat. Okay? And if they say they're proud of it, they're lying to you. And so I guess the first thing I would say is stop lying, right? Just stop lying. Stop trying to pull the wool over our eyes and stop lying to yourself. Okay? Stop lying to yourself. That's the first step to overcoming almost every problem that people have, is stop lying to themselves about their problems. It's true of fat people. It's true of drug addicts. It's true of drunkards and people of gambling problems. People with vice problems, they usually have to stop lying to themselves before they can overcome these problems. Okay, let's see here if there are some other questions. Fat tax as a start. Yeah, I think we should definitely have fat taxes. Reed Johnson, blowing up Nord Stream likely checked a number of boxes for a number of parties that certainly benefit the state-owned oil and gas companies in Denmark, Norway, Poland, etc. Yeah, there are a lot of people who have perhaps rational economic motives for doing this kind of stuff. And they would have the means and opportunity, because if you're a gas company and you build gas pipelines, surely you know how to blow up gas pipelines too. So it is possible that there's some oligarchical shenanigans going on here, that people are engaged in highly unscrupulous business. And because of the fog of war, they think they can get away with it. That's definitely a real possibility. So thank you for that. That's actually very useful. Reed Johnson says to Archie, I hear Oliver Stone's platoon gets good marks from veterans. That's interesting. I couldn't watch that movie. Sorry, I couldn't get through it. I do like some of Oliver Stone's movies. But honestly, my favorite Oliver Stone movie is one of his least acclaimed, and that's The Doors. I thought that was a superb film, actually. Jasper writes in with $50. If you can trust Western news reports, it seems that Ukraine is successfully pushing back Russia's invasion. Well, let me just stop you right there. If you trust Russian media and Russian war bloggers, you also are hearing that the Ukraine is successfully pushing back the Russian invasion. They pretty much pushed them out of the Kharkiv area in the north, and they're making a lot of progress in the Kherson area in the south. And there's a great deal of tears about this and anger about this from pro-war Russians, people who are to the right of Putin on this. And you know things are getting bad when you start seeing pro-war Russians sharing, okay, this is hilarious, they're sharing the Putin ape memes that the Ukrainians were sharing for a long time. Now pro-war Russians are sharing the Putin chimp memes. So I think they're getting disillusioned with Putin. So yeah, okay. I view this positively, but it's also concerning. A nuclear Russia may react with devastating irrationality if backed into a corner. It makes me wonder if we should be careful what we wish for. How do you view Putin's threat of using nukes? Yeah, it's concerning. Absolutely. There are people who are evil enough to want to bring the world down rather than lose. Or if they lose, they're going to make other people suffer. I mean, the entire nation of Israel and its leadership is evil enough to contemplate ruining the world if they go down. It's just malignant narcissism on a colossal scale. Think about Jonestown, right? Jonestown was created by this malignant narcissist, Jim Jones, who created this little paradise for himself based on lies and manipulation and gaslighting and a whole web of manipulation. This vast architecture of lies and manipulation that he created, Jonestown, and when it was crashing down, did he take responsibility? Did he say, okay, it's over, I made some mistakes? No. He wanted all these people to die with him. If he couldn't be running things, they couldn't be around, right? His little world was ending and their world had to end too. It's an incredibly malignant, narcissistic mentality. And it's perfectly possible that Putin is that crazy. I don't think so, though. I think he's actually quite cynical. There's a lot of what I see as calculated nuclear saber rattling going on here, and it's been going on from the start. This is clear with the talking point that this is a quote unquote existential issue for Putin. If it's existential, if it's about the very existence of Russia, then of course he might be willing to use nukes. Well, the idea that this is an existential conflict is preposterous to me. The idea that Russia can't exist behind its 2013 borders is preposterous. The idea that Russia can't exist as the world's largest land empire with vast amounts of valuable resources is preposterous to me. Russia can't exist without taking territory in Ukraine. Are you mad? Are you crazy? The only way in which Russia can't exist without taking territory in Ukraine is if Russia has a deeply flawed, psychopathic self-image. And that, unfortunately, is the problem here. That's the problem with empires. There are people who do feel that Russia can't exist without being an empire. Well, maybe Russia, the nation, can exist behind its 2013 borders, but the Russian imperial mentality can't exist behind its 2013 borders. It can't be at peace with its neighbors. And it's a problem. It would be nice if the Russian nation could live and the Russian imperial ideology that's driving this war could die. The trouble is that the people who believe this imperialist ideology are running the Kremlin. And so it's a very, very dangerous thing. Let's hope, though, that they're patient. I do believe that the first nation that uses nuclear weapons and anger again, of course, it was the United States who did it first, right? We're the only ones who have done it so far. But the next time it's used in anger, the citizens of that nation will not be safe anywhere in the world. I think there's been such a dread of nuclear war that has been steeped into all of us for decades now, for generations now, that if some country broke that ban, broke that taboo, that its citizens wouldn't be safe anywhere in the world. I think if Israel dropped the bomb on Tehran, that Jews would be hunted down and killed in places like Miami and New York City and San Francisco and Los Angeles, the places where they feel the safest. I don't think they'd be safe anywhere in the world. I think that if Russia dropped the bomb, that Russians anywhere in the world would not be safe. And I think that on some level, some people realize this and they don't want to cross that line. At least I hope they don't want to cross that line. But it is definitely concerning. There's no question about it. Friedrich writes in with 10 US dollars. Hello, Greg. What attitude do you think we should have towards genuine fellow white nationalists with too much of a conspiracy streak that could detract from our credibility? Well, I think this is a very, very good question. Now, I do not reject quote unquote conspiracy theorizing as such, not at all. I think that the masterpiece of conspiracy theorizing, if you will, is understanding the Jewish question, frankly, and understanding the Jewish role in engineering the downfall of white nations, the process that we call white dispossession, ultimately that we call white genocide or the Great Replacement. I think it's an absolute masterpiece of conspiracy theorizing, and it's true. There can be true theories. There can be true scientific theories. There can be true historical theories. There can be true theories about conspiracies. Conspiracies are the bread and butter of the legal world. Quite a lot of legal cases are cases for conspiracy. So the idea that talking about conspiracy is ipso facto disqualifying is just an absurd bit of nonsense that the left likes to use because they're sick of losing arguments and they want to shut debate down. They're just so tired of losing to us all the time. It's just the way that they want to stop thought and deflect people from thinking about important issues that we're framing in conspiratorial terms. That's all well and good, but the question is not to have conspiracy theories or not. The question is, are they good or not? Are they rational or not? The cringe-inducing conspiracy theories are not rational. They're false, or they're stupid. They're crazy. They're nuts. They're implausible. That's what bothers me about bad conspiracy theories. Not that they're theorizing about conspiracies, but that they're theorizing about conspiracies in a sloppy way that doesn't pass the laugh test or the smell test. Generally, you can tell when you're in the realm of the bad conspiracy theories because What they do is, instead of offering you plausible evidence, they start offering you metaphysical certitudes. So instead of showing that event A and event B happening together is not a coincidence, that there's an actual causal connection between the two, instead of showing the causal connection, they'll simply airily announce the metaphysical principle that there are no accidents. Well, bullshit. That's not true. There are accidents. Yeah, there are definitely accidents in the world. And if you can't show that A and B are connected in a real way, you can't argue that everything, there are no coincidences, that there are no accidents, that everything is necessary, right? That's a metaphysical dogma, and it's usually trotted out to hide the vacuousness of their theory, the lack of real evidence, the lack of real plausibility of their theory. So I have a piece about conspiracy theories at Countercurrents. I've got a couple pieces. I have a piece on the paranoid style and white nationalism, which deals, you know, with that. And I have a piece on the conspiracy canard and the Epstein death. The Epstein death was obviously a conspiracy. Obviously. You had people going around saying, I don't usually go in for conspiracies, but it was obviously a conspiracy. So I think that the question is whether or not conspiracies are well-constructed, if they're rational or not. And one of the tells is when they get metaphysical on you. There are no accidents. No, that's a metaphysical claim. That's not an excuse for having a theory and saying that two things are connected and not being able to show it, right? So anyway, that's my thought. That's what undermines the credibility of the movement, is if you have people who are irrational in it. And that doesn't just apply to conspiracies. That applies to everything, right? If you have people whose basic style is irrational, not just conspiratorial, but irrational in the broad sense, that undermines our credibility as well. So yeah, the problem is not conspiracy. The problem is irrationality. That's how I put it. Jasper writes in with $50. That's very generous. Thank you. I recently started watching The Waltons for the first time. Not every episode is perfect, but the theme of a three-generation white family with seven kids maintaining and respecting connection to the land where their ancestors lived is refreshingly based. I can't help but think of Blood and Soil when I watch it. Do you have an opinion of the show? Honestly, I don't. I know it was on for years and years, I guess in the 70s into the 80s. Is that right? But I don't know. I don't know about it. And it might actually be extremely good, and I might be missing a lot. So thank you. I wish I could volunteer an intelligent opinion about the Waltons, but thank you for that. ABC writes in with $10. Thank you. What about the phenomenon of enclothed cognition? The color of your skin is your uniform in this ultimate battle for the survival of the West, George Lincoln Rockwell. Using an abstract analogy, does the Marxist globalist left try to deprive the white man of any form of higher cognition? I don't know what you mean there. Honestly, I'm guessing what you mean. I'm not sure. But I will say that, and there's a piece that I've written in Defense of Prejudice that talks about this, that the people who basically spread anti-racism are actually striking at the roots of rationality. And that noticing kinds in the world, natural kinds in the world, and coming up with generalizations about them that you use as a basis for predicting their future behavior simply is intelligence. That means that anti-racism is just principled stupidity, that they're demanding that you practice. Of course, they won't practice it themselves, right? They've got their own very racist generalizations and their own agenda, et cetera, et cetera. But they're just using it as a weapon against white people to make us stupid on principle. And the people who are most stupid on principle are libertarians, libertarian individualists. That's just stupidity on principle. And they will actually righteously talk about how they're blind to color. I'm sorry, but blindness is not a virtue. Poking out your eyes is not a virtue. Being a chump is not a virtue. So Unknown Californian writes in with $3. Thank you. That's very generous. I'm loving what you're saying here, Greg. I wholeheartedly believe in what you're saying. I'm not even sure what you're talking about, but I love that you like what I'm saying. So thank you very much. Unknown Californian writes in with $10. I'm suffering from diversity depression. I took my family out to the Halloween store for some decorations, and the stores were filled with Mexicans and Blacks. I have to keep my head on a swivel these days in these people's presence. Couldn't really enjoy seeing the excitement on my three-year-old's face. I'm so sorry to hear that. I'm so sorry that you're going through that. That loss, that alienation is something that many white people are going through, especially in California. I wrote a piece years ago about Christmas shopping in the Bay Area called Plastic Christmas, just talking about the shocking alienation that I experienced trying to reconstitute for the first time the experience I had as a kid with growing up with the Christmas tree. I had my first adult Christmas tree about a decade ago, and I decided, okay, I'm going to get a Christmas tree and I'm going to decorate it. And so I went out and found that the Christmas that I remember as a child had been replaced by globalized plastic crap. And that's the only thing I could find. I went looking for ornaments. I went to a Target store south of San Francisco on the peninsula and felt that I had been parachuted into Guatemala or something like that. It was shocking. It was basically stepping into a time machine and seeing the future of white erasure that's waiting for us all. It was there already in that particular store. And it's profoundly alienating. I don't know what to say. We have a movement to overcome this, and it might take decades. And your three-year-old might be a dad by the time his three-year-old has a better experience shopping for Halloween costumes and candy. I'm just sorry to say that. I want to do a quick response to something from The Rest. The Rest writes in, do you deny that the U.S. government promotes transsexualism around the world? No, I don't. I don't deny that the U.S. government promotes transsexualism all around the world in some sense or another by putting up, are they putting up the tranny version of the rainbow flag now at embassies and stuff like that? Probably they're doing that. I don't know. We're promoting it certainly by having Rachel Levine in a public role in the United States government, etc. Yeah, so we certainly have tranny-friendly platitudes and pieties, especially being put forward by the Biden administration. I don't deny that. However, I would like to point out something here, because I think this is connected with Russia and the Russia war, right? Do you deny the claim that people like Mike Enoch and Wormtongue Stryker are making about the United States is trying to push transsexualism all around the globe, and this is why we need to side with based Putin? It could be the motive. Let me just point out that it's very interesting that the Russian government through Russia Today also promotes transsexualism around the world. What, you say? Yes, Russia Today promotes transsexualism around the world. Now, it's very interesting. What Russia Today does in the United States is they promote articles about people who are having regrets about transitioning. Okay, that's interesting. Why are they doing that? Well, is it because they're based? Well, let's look at Russia Today in Latin America. Russia Today in Latin America is promoting ideas about the struggles of trans people for recognition of their basic humanity and their right to health care. I kid you not. So what's going on here? Well, what Russia is doing is they are promoting the opposite of whatever is dominant in these societies. Since in the United States, pieties towards trannies are dominant, they're promoting doubt about transsexualism. In healthier societies in Latin America, where the transsexual craze has not taken root, they're promoting the very kind of propaganda that was being promoted in the United States by the trans lobby to get us to this dystopian situation that we're in today. So they're not promoting transsexualism on principle. They're just promoting whatever creates chaos in other societies. I guess you could understand why they would want to promote chaos in the United States. I mean, we're their great global rival. Why would they want to promote chaos in Colombia, Brazil? Why would they want to do that? Well, it's just what Russian propaganda does. And there's a lot of analysis of this, a documentation of this. It goes back to the communist era. They promote anything that destabilizes other countries that they don't control. Now, if the United States did something so transparently cynical, you, the rest, might well denounce it as a cancer on the planet. I want you to consider denouncing Russia as a cancer on the planet for doing something that cynical as well. So anyway, Gadius wants me to comment on the recent controversy about anti-Americanism in the dissident right. This came out of a stream with Academic Agent, I guess. That's how it blew up. I'm not a big listener of streams, honestly. I make streams, but I don't listen to them very often. I just don't have time. I'm busy writing and reading. So anyway, I don't know the actual back and forth, but I've seen some of the polemics and flame wars going on about this. I just have a few comments here. It's all so tiresome. That's my first comment. Because the stuff that's being talked about here is stuff that I have talked about years ago and I thought very successfully put to rest. For instance, the meme that Americans aren't really a people, that we're not an ethnic group, that we're just some detritus from Europe that is somehow, you know, miscegenated together into a, I don't know, homogeneous, uniform, generic white person, and that the only thing that passes for an ethnicity, a culture, is a contrived form of civic nationalism. I've seen these memes being pushed in this conversation, and that's just rubbish. That's nonsense. That doesn't understand what America is. It's very much the most jaundiced European New Right or just sort of European far right caricature of Americans. Okay. Americans are a people. We do not have simply a civic nationalist identity. We have an actual ethnic identity. Yes, we are an offshoot of Great Britain. Culturally, linguistically, legally, we are very Anglo, yet we have absorbed a great deal of others, other peoples from Europe. We have absorbed a lot of Germany. A lot of Germans are part of the American fabric. Many things in the American language are from German rather than English per se. There are many expressions in America that are not present or common in Anglo-English because these are anglicized German expressions. One of the books that I most recommend, it's enormous, but it's a great pleasure to read and you can just breeze through it in bits and snatches, is The American Language by H.L. Mencken. It's very interesting in showing that the American language is different from the English language. And what differentiates it is America's different history in the New World, before and after the Revolution. America started mutating into a distinct people long before the Revolution. We have absorbed other peoples from Europe, other folkways, and we have become a distinct people. We're not generic Anglo-speaking colonial white people. We're Americans. And north of us are Canadians, and Canadians are a distinct ethnic group. I've had a lot of experience with Canadians, and I can tell you that Canadians and Americans are not the same people. We're very similar in a lot of ways, and if you don't really spend much time around them looking carefully at how they behave, you could mistake them for one another, but they're distinct peoples. There is a process of ethnogenesis that has taken place in these European settler societies in the Anglosphere and also in the Hispanosphere, if you want to use that term, in Central and South America. There are distinct societies that have come about with different histories and different folkways, and they're not all uniform. So Americans are a distinct people. We are not simply cringe civnats, like a lot of people have said. And the idea that America, from its very start, was somehow a liberal democratic ideological project is just false. The idea that America was a liberal democratic experiment, a Lockean experiment, is just a false story that's been foisted upon the founding of America by ideologues. It was foisted on us in the early 19th century by Daniel Webster. It was taken up after large numbers of Jews came to our shores and they wanted to rework the American identity in a way that didn't exclude them. And so the idea of America as a Lockean liberal secular state was very appealing, and that was promoted by writers on the right, for instance, like Leo Strauss, as a conception of America that was not exclusive of Jews, for instance. So this image of America as the liberal society, as a creedal society, as having a thin to none culture of its own, that is a construct that has nothing to do with American history. It's a false construct, and it's a laughably false construct if you know anything about American history. So anyway, I think that the people who want to go at Americans in those terms are just barking up the wrong tree. Now, is it true that America is a problem in the world? Yeah, well, America's a problem in the world, but let's not engage in scapegoating, okay? For instance, what are the worst things that America is doing in the world right now? Well, you know, leftist ideas. We're pushing leftist ideas, crazy, crazy leftist ideas. Were all these crazy leftist ideas invented in America? Shockingly, many of them weren't. Shockingly, many of these ideas were adopted in the 19th century. Americans who were adopting fashionable nonsense from Europe as part of their European vacations, as part of their European educations. So let's not be scapegoating Americans here, okay? America is very powerful. It's definitely the greatest power in the world today. However, a lot of the crappy things that America is doing with its power are not indigenous to America. It's not to be entirely put on America. In fact, a lot of the things that America is doing that's wrong is cheerfully accepted and encouraged by European countries that are supposedly victims of this. And in fact, these countries think that Americans are retrograde and need to catch up with them in embracing the most crazed implications of leftism. So let's not blame America for this. America is just as much a victim, if you will, as a perpetrator of bad modernist leftist ideas. We're just in a position where people want to blame us for it because we're so powerful right now. Well, that's a very shallow understanding of how the world works. I don't say that as an American because I'm offended by it. I say that as a white nationalist because I think that if we're going to win, and we're going to win basically by talking our way out of this, because that's the only power we've got, the power of speech on the internet in these little channels of our own media, we're going to talk our way out of this, but we're not going to talk our way out of this by sounding like crazy people. We're not going to talk our way out of this by making broad, sweeping generalizations that aren't based on reality. We're not going to talk our way out of it like that. We're going to talk our way out of it by saying things that are rational and well-founded and lead to predictions about how things are unfolding, throw light upon what's going on, and give us credibility in the eyes of people who are searching for an understanding. And this kind of sloppy talk, it doesn't do that. It just harms our credibility. So, you know, let's just cool it with the anti-American remarks here, people. It's a little too broad brush, and it makes us look foolish. Those are my thoughts on it. Unknown Californian writes in with another $10. Thank you. I'm so grateful coming home and tuning into your show. Everything you say, Greg, is so edifying. You give me hope and courage and strength. Well, thank you so much. I'm glad to hear from you again. I hadn't seen you commenting here for a while, so it's good to have you back. Westwatch says, what does America think about USA's Freemasonic origins? I think it's a little overblown to talk about America's Freemasonic origins, okay? But a lot of these people were Freemasons, and I think at the time Freemasonry was a very good thing. I have a piece at Countercurrents called Lessing's Ideal Conservative Freemasonry. And I hope somebody will link that in the chat. I hope you read it. I think it's extremely important. It's one of my better essays. I'm rather proud of it. Gotthold Ephraim Lessing was an 18th century German writer. He was a philosopher, and he wrote plays, and he was a great man of letters. And he wrote a piece called Ernst and Falk, Dialogues on Freemasonry. And he talks about Freemasonry, and he lays out a critique of Freemasonry that also sketches out kind of ideal Freemasonry that's completely consistent with ethno-nationalism, interestingly enough. So I think that's worth looking at. And I say something there that's very candid. I say that I'm not patient with extreme broad brush reactionary attitudes, and that Joe Sobrin was fond of asking liberals, is there a society in which you would be a conservative? And that was a flustering thing for them. I have adopted a similar question to right-wing radicals. Is there a society in which you would be a leftist? And I have to say that under the monarchies of the 18th century, I would be a leftist. I would be a radical leftist. If I lived in France in the 18th century, I would be a Freemason. And I think that that is something that needs to be treated seriously. One of the things that Freemasonry made possible was a platform in which people could communicate with one another that was above sectarian religious differences. This, of course, was motivated by the century of bloodshed after the Reformation. More than a century of bloodshed after the Reformation. Almost 150 years of bloodshed and destruction that came in the wake of the Reformation, made people think, okay, we need alternative institutions. So they evolved concepts like the sovereign state and nationalism, national self-determination, national sovereignty. And they evolved Freemasonry as a kind of institution that stood above confessional divides and made it possible for people to meet and communicate and not to fall back into the bloodshed of the post-Reformation world. So I think it was something that was valuable for that alone. And Lessing's account of the logic of Freemasonry, I think, is a model that can be used for understanding what's good about our movement today. So I think that's very interesting. Westwatch says Freemasonry emancipated Jews. This is true. This is one of the problems. Well, liberalism emancipated Jews, put it that way. But Jews, of course, got involved in this because it wasn't closed to them. But the people who go on today about Judeo-Freemasonry and stuff like that, a lot of them are generally Catholic, and they're angry at Freemasonry because Freemasonry in Catholic countries was one of the main forces against the state power of the church, or the state empowering the church. And that is something that I don't support. I like separation of church and state. And they argued for things like that. I think that's a good thing. I think it was that was genuine progress, if you will. GAE is a false shibboleth, another way to divide whites. It smells very Jewish. Oh, the global American empire pronounced gay. Yeah, I think it's juvenile. It's sort of pizza-faced, juvenile gamer talk. And I think it was popularized or maybe even coined by Warren Beatty, who is indeed Jewish. And of course, when you talk about the global American empire, that, well, it's three letters that don't go Z-O-G, right? Zionist occupied government, which does throw a certain light on Jews, which may be why Beatty wants to throw the light on Americans. Good point. Yeah, I'm going to announce it today. I'm not allowing any of my writers to use GAE or Globo Homo anymore. It's just childish. It all sounds childish. Okay. A lot of deep dives recently in how Jewish the founders were. The founders weren't all that Jewish. There were no Jewish founders. That's just silly. There were no Jewish signatories of the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence. And yeah, they were tolerant of Jews. There's a letter from George Washington to a synagogue, I think in Connecticut or somewhere in New England, that is shockingly naive about Jews and an expression of this desire to get above confessional differences and the Freemasonic idea. It's the liberal idea. And I think liberalism is all well and good with white people. But the trouble is that Jews are not white people. They see themselves as a separate group. And their attitude is to use liberalism as a tool to break down our resistance to their power and upward mobility. But they don't in any way accept any of the debilities that liberalism would put on them, right? To be tolerant of us, to give us a fair shake, et cetera, et cetera. They don't do that. They just use it against us, which is why they need to be excluded. Not because liberalism is a bad thing, but because they're a bad fit for liberalism. So folks, I've been going on for a long time and I'm tired. So I am going to wrap up here and I'm looking forward to being back next week for another episode of Countercurrents Radio. And if things go according to plan, that will be our moderated airing of differences on the Russia-Ukraine conflict with Mark Collett. So thank you very much and goodbye.